Today's April 11th. You're one of Yosef's brothers, and he just identified himself to you. Right? And you're going to say, oh, that makes sense. Does it? The whole time that was you? Wouldn't you think Yaakov would want to know about that? Yosef, you knew those were your brothers, and maybe Yosef can say, I didn't know they were my brothers. No one in the story asks Yosef, why did you do all that? Right? Rabban does, Abarbanel does. You discussed it here in this class, right? In order to recreate the situation, to get the best possible tshuva, a la the Rambam and the tshuva, where the situation has to be replicated in order to have the same circumstances to have real change. Right? A man who committed an indiscretion in his youth with a married woman can hardly do tshuva for that when he's 80. Right? He has another chance to commit adultery at the age of 80, but he chooses not. That's a little different, right? I could be snarky with a Gemara in the Sefer Sanhedrin, where remember that beautiful woman brought in to warm David, and anybody remember his name? Avishai HaShunamis. And she wanted to be intimate with David. And David said, no, I have to do tshuva by not being intimate with you, who I can, for a time when I was intimate with a woman when I shouldn't have been. You get the tshuva? Right? Anybody remember her snarky response in the Gemara? The God of stealing, he claims that it's because he wants to do tshuva. So, Chazal put such snarky, disrespectful words into Avishai. But in other words, he's saying, I don't accept your tshuva because you are not in a position, you know. So, I can't tell you this is a family of listening to the Hawaii Torah. But you have to see what the Gemara's response was, what David did afterwards, in order to tell her, to show her that she was wrong in her assessment of why he's not doing it. But I ain't shown it in the Sefer Sanhedrin of Chabal. So the in our instance, can you assume that Yaakov would ask Yosef, you know, Yosef, let's have a chat. You know, you knew that those were your brothers. Why did you do all that? And why didn't you contact me for 9 years? Right? What kind of conversations went on during that time? Right. So this is our goal for the rest of the semester, basically, to finish off Sefer Bereishis with is Bereishis really fixed? Is there really a tikkun for this Sefer? The thing that may make us feel not, we've already discussed here in this class, is that after Yaakov died, the brothers went over to Yosef and said, now that our father is dead, and they made up a story, remember? We discussed this last class. They made up a story. Yaakov never knew that Yosef was sold. And if Yaakov had known such a thing, he probably wouldn't think that Yosef would be so vindictive as to want to kill them for it. And if Yaakov really felt that Yosef would be vindictive for it, surely it makes more sense for him to tell Yosef directly not to kill your brothers than to tell them to tell Yosef not to kill them. Right? One of the three lies the Gemara says in Vamasas Samachbeis, we did this last class. But just the idea that the brothers said, Lo yistameinu Yosef, now that daddy's dead, remember that was 17 years Yaakov was alive. It's not like this is all in a week or two. In 17 years, Yosef has not demonstrated anything in those 17 years that should make you feel that he is okay, that he forgives you. Anybody have any comments on that? Tanakh doesn't tell us anything. Did they have barbecues together? Did he invite them to the palace for some bingo nights or or some other kind of a celebration, maybe an annual event, maybe, with all the grandchildren, a family gathering. Is there anything that Yosef might have done during those 17 years to or Adaraba? Were there some things he was doing that made them feel that he wouldn't be so vindictive? Were they just covering their bases? They're covering the grounds? Remember, Yaakov thought that Esav would kill them when Esav didn't want to. Right? Well, that's Rashbam. Rashi said Esav didn't want to kill them, but Hashem didn't let him. But the brothers, are they just trying to play it safe? Let's cover our bases. To be technical, is there any indication from all of it, and I'm going to have to go start with Vayigash, any indication that Yosef did forgive them?
I mean, like he says, he says that like it was all part of Hashem's plan, but he doesn't specifically say that.
So use a better word than forgive.
Excuses.
Right? I don't know if excuse is the same as forgiven in this instance, right? The full, you know, we use different words for what Hashem, we hope Hashem does for us on Yom Kippur. And it's really part, the Mechiras Yosef story is such an important element of Yom Kippur in the writings, especially the Meshech Chochma. Parsha Semar makes a whole treatise out of the need to read about the Asara Hu B'Malchus on Yom Kippur. Why are we reading about Tisha B'Av I get? The sad day, and it's a sad story. But it's not meant to be a sad, to elicit sadness in Yom Kippur. The Gemara says Yom Kippur is one of the two happiest days of the year for the Jews. Right? The other being Tu B'Av. Right? And the Gemara says, oh, we know why Yom Kippur is such a happy day, because you have Kapara, but why is Tu B'Av a happy day? And then it gets off on a tangent about Tu B'Av. In Bava Basra and at the end of Tainus. What are we reading about on Yom Kippur? Because Yom Kippur is a day of atonement, and we have not fully atoned for Yosef yet. Okay. So there are different words that we use for the different things that we do. I think it can be shown that Slach is what we do on Slichas. Machal is what we do on Rosh Hashanah, and Kaper is what we do on Yom Kippur. And these are three very different terminologies. When you step on someone's toe by accident in a supermarket in Israel, you don't turn around and say, you mochel me? You say, sometimes you say to someone you don't even know too well, you go through you're going to a concert, you're being, someone has to get a sleep up. That's the beginning part, right? Mochel is what the governor does to get you off of a party, right? Kapara goes a whole different level. And that's what we have to see, if there's kapara at the end of Sefer Bereishis. The Meshech Chochma seems to imply not, which is what we have to read about it in Yom Kippur. If you want to really be industrious, you might want to ask, so why do we still have to do kapara for the Egel on Yom Kippur? Right? It's the Egel that makes the whole day. It was the 10th of Tishrei, and a good Parshanut can show it was really the 10th of Tishrei that Moshe came down from Har Sinai the last time with the news that you have been forgiven. So why do we still need, why does Moshe say afterwards that this story will always come up to remind you of your sinning? Remember, you know, I'm talking this paraphrasing the Pasuk in Shmos, that this story will always pile on to other stories. Why? We've got a kapara for the Egel. 3,000 people died. As far as the Midbar goes, those are small numbers. 24,000 died in Baal Peor. Just 3,000 people. Okay, I can't believe that those 3,000 people died indiscriminately. Those 3,000 did something a lot worse than everybody else. And those, why did Moshe come down after those 3,000 people were killed, saying, Atem chatosem chato'ogit Allah, you sinned a great sin. Let me tell you what you did. So why didn't they also die? Apparently there were different levels of sinning by Yehiel. Yes?
The lessons, like, in some way, kind of like a similar flaw as with Yehiel. So.
Yes, we'll see where that's going to come up also. But we don't have full, we might have Slicha and Mechila, but we don't have full Kapar. It's interesting also, just because to fix Voracious, there has to be some Yom Kippur tones to it. It's interesting that we refer to God in our daily davening as a Soleach Umalcheh, right? But we don't talk about God giving us kapara on a daily basis. Right? We do say in Yom Kippur, Slach Lanu Mechal Lanu Kaper Lanu. We have a special day for that. Right? And we also say, we have very interesting, we say, Ki ato sochon umochalon v'shivtei yishurun. Does that sound familiar in the liturgy of Yom Kippur? Very strange formulation, right? It's at the end of the bracha for Yom Kippur, for the Kiddushas Hayom of Yom Kippur, right? And in Shalosh Regalim, it ends Bracha Hashem Kadesh Yisrael Vazmanim. On Shabbos, Bracha Hashem Kadesh Shabbos. On Yom Kippur, it's Ki Ato Solchon Umacholon B'Shivtei Yishurun, and it goes on, and it says. Melech HaKol Aretz, Mekadesh Shemo Yisrael, V'Yom HaKippurim. Right? What is this? If you guys knew the Daf Yomi last week, there's a fascinating answer to this question. The Gemara in the second parak so it's a few weeks ago, talks about the difference between an animal that's rovates, tachas masa'o, and an animal that's a rav tson. Anybody speak Hebrew well enough to tell me what's the difference between a koes and a kason?
A koes is the
difference between a marachem and a rachmon.
So all those are koes, is someone who counts as a koes, meaning it's action as opposed to someone who embodies that. And a rachmon is someone who's like merciful. He is a merciful person as opposed to someone who is marachem.
Yeah, you can have a cruel person who happens to be marachem at this moment. Who's behaving with mercy right now, Rahman, is someone who is defined by mercy. Like Rahman, right? The son is someone who is constantly angry. Koes, he's angry now. You don't have to be a Kasan to be Koes. I mean, it's a simple grammar, right? The Gemara talks in here, this is what the Gemara does, Rovates is someone who is an animal that is crouching under its weight. A Rahman is an animal that's always doing that, whether it's carrying a weight or not. And there might be a nafkamina with your obligation of prika and te'ina. Ring a bell? And this is already now perikamavki. So why do we call God a solchon mochalon? So we're telling God, Baruch Shalom, God, please, we don't just be a soleach mochel. That's for the rest of the year. For Yom Kippur, we want you to be not just have rachamonis, be a rachamon. You get it? It's a rare formulation in biblical Hebrew. I've been searching and searching. I only found one word in Tanakh like this. There's a pasuk in Eicha that speaks about women who are nashim rachmaniyot. Now, I didn't find this formulation. If you know one, please tell me. Right? Where you have the nun. There's no word like it at all. But I only found it in Eicha. And again, nashim rachmaniyot. You get it? It's not nashim hamarachmot. It's nashim rachmaniyot. It's ironic that in that pasuk, those women are not doing something that elicits mercy. Remember what they're doing in the pasuk that describes nashim rachmaniyot in Eicha? They're eating their children.
Oh, okay.
Merciful. It's meant to be b'derech afloga, probably. But anyway, so solchon u'mochalon. So shvita b'tal Hashem. We want you to be in constant slicha and mechila mode. So let Hashem look at that, and you see what a very unusual terminology for usually you refer to Bnei Yisrael as Lishivtei Yisrael. Right? So new, what's going on here? Hashem says, okay, it's a drash on the Yashrus, the first three letters of our name as a nation. He says, I'm ready to be in Soleich and Mochel mode, as long as you are in Yashrus mode. You get it? That's why I put a nun at the end of the name of Israel. Okay?
Why is there no Kafran? Or why?
So, because Kafran has other bad connotations to it. Kafran is a disbeliever. Kofar. Now, the word Kuf Pei Resh has many, many different meanings in Tanakh. It's like 10 different words that have the Shorish Kuf Pei Resh in Tanakh. Kapores, Kofar, Kapara, of course. It means a lot of different things. There's even a type of a vegetation called the Kufra. In Aramaic. What are all these things? Were they
Kufra
those?
Is like a date? It's like a stage of dates?
Yes.
Yeah, you know that.
I look at Mara.
It's in the sixth paragon.
Oh, shit. Six
brachas. It's in the barfin. So there is a common etymology, though, in the word, which seems to be interestingly phonetically similar. Kuf. Okay. So everything that had the type of fruit that has a certain type of cover in it that at that stage of its growth. Okay, be that as it may, we're going to now turn our attention to the beginning of Vayeshev. Alright. Yehuda makes his plea to his brother. This harps back to what I said earlier, is that in the decision making over who is going to be the king over all these other brothers, which tribe is going to get that reputation? Who deserves to carry the shevet, lo yosur shevet, the Yehuda mechokek, right? It should obviously be Yosef. But it could be, I'm suggesting to you, that Yaakov's evaluation of his sons for 17 years to determine what is going to be their destiny, that Yaakov's evaluation of his sons has it that Yosef abused his position. I did that last class when we talked about the Haftorah of Miketz when it's not Hanukkah. That connected to Shlomo, remember? You also remember? Shlomo abuses his position as king to make a room full of gasping people thinking he actually has the right to take a baby and slice it in half to determine who's the real mother. Of course, you know he never meant to do it. But you know what, Shlomo? It's also wrong to make people think that you have the right to do so. So an abuse of power removes you from your kingdom, kibiyochol. It leads to the irony of the split kingdom instead of the split baby. And the abuse of power that Yaakov feels will manifest itself to too great an extent in the future to his descendants, let me give it to, now, you know, I'm just contradicting myself, didn't I? It seems that Shlomo is abusing. Okay, so be it. If you do, there'll be a price to pay. David abuses his power also when he says to split the field. Remember that? We talked about that? Between Siva and Mephibosheth. Okay?
It doesn't have an effect on David's descendants.
It does have an effect that down the line, well, Gemara Yuma says that you find it so easy to just Paskin to split the field of the son of Shaul, of the grandson of Shaul, with just without giving much attention to what the real answer is here. Anyone could see that Mephibosheth was a victim of slander from Tziva. So David not paying any proper attention to the situation at hand. So Chayecha, it's an irony. It's the same irony that made Adam responds to Ayeka in not a good way, blaming him on his wife. May Cain respond to Ehebel Ochicha in the same way.
Right.
not take responsibility. You know, the child is going to see what's going on across the and as he's growing up, and don't be so amazed if he becomes like the fox.
So yes, like Shlomo is
Shlomo, yes, right. So Shlomo saw that, and Shlomo wasn't in the field when he said split the field, but it's just that irony that made Shlomo's son Chavam, you all know what I'm talking about in Malachim Aleph, react in such an obviously wrong way to the entreaty of his people, the commission that said, let's lower some taxes here, and instead of listening to the elders, he listened to the children and gave them bad advice.
It is funny that even though Yosef lost it, we potentially say that his son is worth a tikkun to the whole.
Possible, and therefore a malchus does come to a frying. Right? There's two kingdoms.
Right.
That's why there's a Mashiach ben Yosef and a Mashiach ben David. You've heard of that concept, right? It's not a huge concept in the Talmud.
Yeah, Yosef lost it because he was like
abused it and abuses it and negates.
Well, by the kind of
putting the brothers through all of that to too great an extent. He should have known already that tshuva was accomplished. The way they reacted.
Wasn't it the tshuva by Benjamin? Wasn't that like the whole?
Yeah. But it wasn't necessary. The reader knows that the brothers already made their peace with Binyamin's favoritism.
Right.
Yosef may not know that, so he has to do it for himself, but that's where he goes too far. It's been 9 years, you know. Yeah. Yaakov must have wondered, you know, tell me, I want to know more and more. I would. Everyone here would want to know, what happened to you? It's been 22 years. What happened to you? The irony that Yaakov was also away from his parents for 22 years. Don't think the Chazal don't make a big thing about that. Right?
So, Joseph was away from his parents for 22 years.
From the age of 17 to the age of 39.
And so
Yaakov was away exactly 22 years.
Right. And Yaakov was also, is there any connection between the fact that Yaakov was that Yosef was 17 years when he left Yaakov, and Yaakov had 17 years with him after?
Yes, there is it's in my book, but yes, I mean, that's famous, because I took it from, it's not in Chazal, this is in Chazal, and it says, Vayehiyu Chayei Sara, that's Gematria 37, right, you get it?
What is 90? What is attractive?
She was 90 when he was born. You got it? She had 37 years with Yitzhak.
Right. Okay.
I'm not sure about you. The first word in Vayechi, you get it right away, it's 34.
Oh, so we had 34 years. With
17.
Right. 17
is a 22-year hiatus, and then another 17 afterwards. Okay. The 17 years Yaakov gets afterwards, there's a lot in Chazal. I have a few things on that. You'll enjoy it. There's some very interesting things that Chazal noticed about the amount of time Yaakov gets and why he lived so much less than Achim and Yitzchak. Okay, so you can see that. All right, so...
Don't they say there's no words? He said the power of
Yeah, it's a Mamre Chazal about the way he spoke to power. Okay, so let's now, we are in Parshas Vayigash. Okay. We're starting with Perek Mem Hei Pasuk. Mem Hei Al. Okay? Mem Hei Pasuk. Everyone get up. Maybe I see some of you who were here for my Chumash Megillah class, but this is just something that showed up in that class because it's the story of Rus. That's what we're up to now. And part of the way I'm teaching Megillas Rus, which I think is shy, I could just mention in passing now, is that Rus is somewhat of a tikkun of the the problems of the Yosef story. Both involve a story where two boys die, where there's an opportunity of one to perpetuate the other that's refused, right? Even the refusal sounds familiar, similar. Pen ashchis es nachosi, vayashchis es zaro artsan ha-vayishpoh, or vayipol, or, you know, some other word for spilling your seed on the ground, but vayashchis, destroy the seed on the ground. And at the end of the story, there's a boy born, in the case of Tamar, two boys to replace the two. In the case of Rus, there's only one boy born because only one woman is remarrying. And the phenomenal Masoretic anomaly is that both in all of Rus and in all of Vayeshev, get this, every pasuk in both but eight begin with the letter Vav. There's no other parsha that comes close to this kind of phenomenon except Vayetze. Vayetze also has a lot of pasukim beginning with the letter Vav. But Vayeshev is 112 pasukim. So that means 104 out of 112 pasukim begin with the letter Vav. That's a huge standard deviation from the rest of the talk.
Who made the divisions of the parsha?
The Gemara, the end of Megillah already knows about divisions like that. To read the Torah every 3 years,
right.
That's part of the Masorah of Machi Knesset.
Right, exactly. You're saying the reading 1 year was already...
This division, I can tell you, and this is in my Bamidbar book, is that there's some discrepancies. It seems that Bamidbar is... We read the beginning of Naso in the wrong place.
Based on what the Dazish
is. Because, no, based on the way Bamidbar ends. The last passage in Bamidbar is Kabbalah is a Kodesh Vamesu. You're not allowed to end an aliyah with a word like that. Certainly not a whole parsha. Apparently, Naso began with the first Naso. That's at the end of Bamidbar. But then Naso would have had 210. So again, Bamidbar would have had 110. So in other words, instead we took from Naso, there are three Nasos, Naso is Roshan, so the three sons of Levi, and we Bamidbar ends with the first Naso.
Okay.
So that was supposed to be in Parshas Naso, all three Naso.
Interesting.
So we took some Bamidbar and tacked it onto Naso. But these are delineations made by Ashkenazi. No, the delineations of how we read Parshios has been settled pretty much.
So all communities agree the same, like
pretty much. Ashkenazi and Sephardim. That's it. Yes. I don't think anyone is still reading every 3 years. The rabbi himself talks about it and says, "Eino min pashut." Not a widespread minog anymore, which means that at the time of the Rambam, there might have still been some places that did it, but not anymore. Not even today. So, Maisa, the Parshas Vayeshev that we have now, and Megillas Rus, amazingly, both have all but eight psukim beginning with the letter Vav. Okay? Which is, means that a story has a lot of, you know, cause and effect. And then there's, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this. And this is because of this. And this is post hoc ergo propter hoc. And then we'll, right? But there's so much more. There's so much more at work here. Yes?
Vayeshev or Vayigash?
Vayeshev. Vayeshev. There's so much more, but the one that really is so pronounced is the Megillas Rus's penchant for putting everything that happens in this book at the doorstep of God. It doesn't say, and Naomi heard that there was food, it's time to go back to Israel. It says, Naomi heard that God brought food back to Israel and said, it's time to go, now you can go back. You know what I'm saying? You can go throughout the book and you'll see about 15 of these. Okay, if you're in my Chumash Megillah, because I gave you an assignment to look them all up, you just circle the names of God. Because the active name, it's not the active, God doesn't say when and God spoke to Boaz. No. But the reference that people make to God is very pronounced in Megillah's verse. Everything that happens in this book, when Naomi finds out that But that Rose came back with so much food because she went to somewhere else.
Hashem.
Yeah, Baruch Hashem is that you came, everything is happening from God. Right? As opposed to Esther, you can also maybe feel that it's coming from God, but it's not mentioned. But as opposed to our story, where the brothers just mentioned God once. Why is God doing this to us? Because the conduit between God and the world, that the Gemara, the Medrash Rabba calls Hamerkava, God's chariot, which is the vehicle to bring God down for mankind to experience God, is in no frame of mind to be that conduit. Because he is excessively mourning over something for which he may blame himself, for the enmity he caused between him and his brothers, and that I sent him out that day and I never heard from him. So he was such a melancholic state that he could not be that calming, soothing, joyful, anything that is going to push God away. How do I know this is so obvious? The pasuk after Yaakov finds out that Yosef is alive begins, "Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov." God's active voice returns to the Torah after a vacation longer than by far longer than any place else in the Torah.
And that's why Rashi says the Shekhinah left Yaakov.
Yeah, it wasn't enough resting in a place that was worthy, but they came back to him. And the spirit returned after finding that Yosef is alive. So Rus, you know, it's like a big tickling for this. Everything is, you know, everyone recognizes God's place. But what about the brothers saying, "Why is God doing this to us?" Is, you know, they realize, yeah, this is God making this happen. But we don't know why.
You not know why.
Right? So this calls to mind, it's really a very endearing Gemara and Daf Tes in Maseches Tainis. The Gemara starts off by saying that Rav Yochanan went to Reish Lakish's son. Anybody know the relationship between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish's son?
Oh, the son.
Lakish's son would be Rav Yochanan's
sister.
Rav Yochanan would be Reish Lakish's son's uncle. Okay? Rav Yochanan was married to this boy. Reish Lakish was married to this boy's, to Reish Lakish's son, was Rav Yochanan's nephew. Right? The boy's mother was Rav Yochanan's sister.
Okay, Reish Lakish's sister was married. So it was sister to Rav Yochanan.
Right. But Matthias the pedalid, he made a shidduch between Reish Lakish and his sister. Okay? So in Tainus and Daf Tes, the Gemara says that he went to this little boy and he said, "What did you learn in yeshiva today?" And the boy said, "Aser to Aser." So he said, "What did your Rebbe teach you? Why it has to say the word twice? Just say to Aser, to Kol Tzavah. What's Aser to Aser?" So he said, "My Rebbe said, as I asked that question. And he said, Aser bishvil titasher. If you tithe properly, you'll become rich." Right? So he said, the Rebbe said, "Really? Are you allowed to? How do you, if you get stuck up for the purpose of becoming rich? That sounds like you're testing God. Are you allowed to test God? Doesn't it say, don't test them?" The boy said, "Listen, that's what my Rebbe said. He said that when it comes to getting stuck up, you can challenge God." And indeed, there are Gemaras like that. You can't go back and take the money out if the thing you wanted didn't happen. You say, "God, I've asked this girl out 7 times and she keeps saying no. I'm putting $100 in this stucker box that this time she should say yes." And then she says no an 8th time and you go back to the stucker box and say, "God, you didn't keep your part, I'm not keeping my part." That's how I'll too kavodim amishash and the serapah and the process. But we have, it's perfectly legitimate to put on tefillin tomorrow morning and say, "God, I have a job interview later today when tefillin is dedicated that I should I should get a good word. It's perfectly legitimate to do all your mitzvahs that way, as long as you don't regret doing the mitzvah if the thing doesn't happen. And let's not get off on this. That's Tosfos' answer. So, Lemaisa, Rav Yochanan says to the boy, your Rebbe is right. When it comes to tzedakah, you're allowed to challenge God. If you know the Gemara, he quoted them a pasuk from Malach. Abiru is called a Hamaiser al Beis Haotze uvechanuni no bezos sineftachas arugos hashamayim ad barikosias to ascham ad bolita. Right? So challenge me, you'll see. I'll give you everything you need if you bring the tithe. But give the tithe to God. So the kid responded with guile. The kid was, I don't know, 5 years old. The kid said, "That pasuk is in Malachi. I haven't gotten to Malachi yet. I'm just barely finished with the Torah. If I had been a little older and got to Malachi, I wouldn't have needed you. I wouldn't need your Rebbe. I would have known myself." So the Rebbe said, "Well, good stuff. Okay, fair enough. I'll challenge you like this. I'm going to give you a pasuk in the Vayim Ksuvim. You tell me where this pasuk is manifest in the Torah. Okay, big shot. You say you know the Torah. Here is the pasuk." I'll paraphrase. The Pasuk in Mishlei. The Pasuk says, the Rasha sows his own seeds of punishment, and when the punishment comes, he blames it on God. Here again, the Rasha causes his own problems with his own Rishus, and when the Rishus comes home to roost and he gets his punishment, he blames it on God. Where is that in the Torah? I'll kick out right away. There could be a few different things like this, like Cain maybe talking that way to God and blaming on God, right? But it's where Reuven says, "I told you." Not Reuven. It's where the other brother says, "Why is God doing this to us?" And they should have realized that this is your own problem. It's your own fault, right? How could they realize that? They don't know that that's Yosef, right? But Reuven later does say, this is where Chazal said that they were such tzaddikim. Reuven said, "I told you you shouldn't sin with the lad. He was crying from the pit and we didn't listen to him." Remember the gorilla, right? It's not there in Vayesha, it's here in Miketz. Right? He was crying out to us from the pit and we didn't hear his cries. Now this is happening to us because of that. Right? So, that's how Chazal know they were such tzaddikim. Why? It's been 22 years. Surely they should have said something like, "I told you we shouldn't have taken those three girls up to our room when we were in the when we were traveling in the Delta. I told you we shouldn't have got, you know, 22 years. You can't find something that happened in the last 22 years that might be the cause of this kind of thing. You have to go back 22 years. It means that they, you know, I guess." So
unless you felt that specifically, it was like a punishment for something
else. It seems ironic. Yes.
Right, exactly.
The irony of, look what's happening to our brothers because look what we did to a brother.
Right.
And they saw the irony of it and they were close to that. Alright, so that Rus becomes this kind of a tikkun by bringing God in it, maybe too much. God is too much in this. How do I know? Because Christians use it. When Rus conceives at the end of the story, what does it say? She slept with Boaz. Gemara says that Boaz died that night, and God gave her pregnancy. Ooh, and she conceived. Child. Good Shabbos. Gemara Nida says that Hashem gives every woman Hayrayon. Right? Oh, but come on, this is a direct line of David. But Jesus is not a direct line of David because he doesn't have a father. So
well, it's
a direct line of David.
Between two different sources of
Jesus. I know. You give two different lines to Joseph. But the bottom line is this, is that Rus is so, Lahachis is so interested in giving you God behind everything that the Christians use this as part of the virgin birth and the, you know, the immaculate conception of God impregnating Mary and stuff like that, all the way back from, you know, Ruth, because it says, and God gave her pregnancy, right? Because Ruth is so adept at telling us everything is happening from God. Good Shabbos. God does everything. Good. Thank you. Okay, yes?
Is that the main tikkun for Ruth?
There are a lot. The tikkun is that we see that another person chooses not to perpetuate the name of a brother. Brother is being judging brotherhood by this time, point to the end of Bereishis. That's why Pliny Almoni doesn't die for refusing to take Rus. He doesn't die, he just goes into oblivion without knowing his real name. I'm not saying his name is Toby, because it's Toby, but Onan does die. Because by this time, after everything we've been through with brothers, for goodness sakes, with all the trauma of trying to get brothers to get along, and for once a person says to his brother, do this for your brother, perpetuate the name of your brother. Right? So to take her and then to do what you did, and ostensibly if God had not killed him, what happens next? He's going to keep doing that every time he sleeps with her. Yeah, some people do that.
Because I remember, I think last year we said that it was to balance David's lineage.
Yeah. Ruth's whole story is written to validate his lineage. Yes.
So they're both the real.
So it's also another very interesting thing is that Christianity had to have the messianic arrival because they deified him. From such a perfection that his mother couldn't even give birth to him as part of a human procreative act, right? How Isaiah 7:14, behold, the virgin shall conceive and give birth to a baby, even though the word isn't virgin, the word is young maiden, right? Alma, which describes married women in Tanakh.
Well, it depends on how it's translated to Greek.
Yeah, it's a big Septuagint, this Christian Septuagint translates it as virgin, but new, more modern translations already started to translate it as maiden.
Yeah, Robert Alter is,
well, Robert was Jewish, but I mean Christian have started to, because if a Christian author in the year 1700 even would say that means young maiden, he would be ostracized. The book would be banned. The word is alma. Look, it's in debates over whether the word, this line, refers to Christian, the Immaculate Conception, is what some scholars claim is what led to Pshat Parshanut in the Middle Ages. The Jews were forced into these disputations at the year 1000 because of the new millennia, they thought was heralding the Second Coming, and they would try to convert all the Jews that would assure that the Second Coming could happen. This fostered many disputations over the years, but especially at this time. And the best offensive the Jew can take to show that this isn't talking about Jesus was to show that it's grammatically incorrect, it's tactically incorrect, it is philologically incorrect, that's not what the word means. And in reality, it's not correct. Virgins don't give birth. So this started to build the fundamental building blocks of Pshat Parshanut. Grammar, context, syntax, reality, philology.
Well, reality is not meaning. The whole point is that it like subverts reality.
Yeah, but the reality is that the whole point of this pasuk is to convince the king of Yehuda not to join a coalition with the northern tribes and Aram against Asher. How does arguably a virgin birth some 600 years from now, how is that supposed to make him feel that it's something happening now, behold, something happening in front of you. And the son of that king is who saved them from the Assyrians. Right? There was once a disputation where a Jew was made this argument And he said, but the person in this verse is supposed to save us from the Assyrians. And he said, maybe snarky, he said, heck, he didn't even save us from the Romans. So the Romans had their way with him. The guy in this verse is supposed to save us from some enemy. You want to argue out of the context that we're talking about the Romans? They saved us from the Romans. They killed him on the spot.
We get a lot of
they killed him. They slaughtered him for making this blasphemous, disrespectful statement. How could this be Jesus? Right? So the Jews were always put into these very unfavorable positions about how to argue.
It was only Ramban who got the
guarantee from James of Aragon, who had just conquered the Muslims to keep Europe Christian, who had the power and the strength against the Pope to assure Ramban that he could make any argument he wanted. Right? It was just that when Pablo Cristiani, who was born Jewish, misrepresented the whole debate to be more favorable to Christianity, Ramban wrote his part of the story. You wouldn't know anything about this if not for this. And they made a movie out of it. It's a great, great film. It's only about an hour and 15 minutes. It's called The Disputation.
So we actually have records of all this back and forth.
It's a good representation of there's a lot more. There's a lot more.
Do you have any historical records of what was argued?
Only was Ramban.
Do the Christians have what they said or no?
Yeah, of course.
Right, so we have both sides of the argument.
Of course, yes. And what's interesting is that if you go online, you'll see that it was a Jew who made it. His name is Makovi. He has made many, many different types of responses to Christian theology. Makovi. And then what you will find online is a whole Christian response to this, to Ramban's disputation. And so I never had time to watch the Christian response, but it might be interesting. I don't know. Pablo Cristiani, for his part, was an ignorant Jew, but tried to show that in reality, the Talmud is filled with references positive about Jesus that the Rishonim turned on its head. It's such other nonsense, but I have a book at home. It's written by a Christian theologian. It's called Jesus in the Talmud, and I enjoy it very much because I wasn't aware of the Christian theological notions that explained to me certain Gemaras I never understood. Now with the Christian theology, I get it. Right? Rabbi Yeshua with the Chachmei Atuna, the wise men of Athens, they asked him about what do you do with the afterbirth of a mule, and what do you do when salt goes bad? The Gemara says that they were supposed to ask three questions that are absurd, and three scientific questions, and three moral questions. And the absurd questions had to do with afterbirth of a mule. And what do you do when salt goes bad? And the third one that was not related, but Rabbi Yeshua answered, salt doesn't go bad. Salt is a preserver, and mules don't give birth. Right? So this book shows through censored versions of the Gemara that it was their way of saying virgins don't give birth. And in the New Testament, they speak of something that's called the salt of the earth. Have you ever heard of that statement?
Yes.
It's the salt of the earth. That's in the New Testament where they say, you Christians, you followers of Jesus, are the true Israel. You are the salt of the earth because the old salt went bad. God turned his back against the old Israel, and now there's new salt. You are the salt of the earth. And so Rabbi Yeshua said, no, salt doesn't go bad. God's covenant with his people is everlasting. God may punish us for rejecting the covenant, but the covenant is, if it's a new covenant, it's a new reason for keeping the covenant. Yahweh himself says why we have the covenant, is that until now I had to punish you when you didn't listen. Now you'll just listen out of it'll be in your hearts. Right? Not a new Torah. It never says a new Torah. It says a new Bris Chavashah, new bris, a new covenant for why you keep the Torah. Anyway, So I find a lot of assistance in this.
The New Testament was known then? You'd be responding to a verse in the New Testament.
By the Gemara, knew the New Testament very well.
Really?
New Testament was quoted in the Gemara a few times. They knew it well. I'm not saying everybody was reading it, but they knew of it and they knew how, the need to respond to it. Yeah. Okay, we're going to come back to this. And we're going to start with Perek Mem Hei next time. And try to come to. There's a lot at stake here because I've got two brothers at the beginning of Shmos also, where a younger one is going to overshadow.
That,
that's going to be very, very important for us. Okay. All right. Questions.